At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by David Coggeshall, who is the writer and co-producer, right, on Orphan First Kill.
Indeed.
I'm a fan of this movie, and I'll talk about why in a second. But I'm really glad to have him on because I want to talk about the moment we are living through, which is described by some as hot horror fall. We're in hot horror summer, hot horror fall. It seems like the only thing that studios are making that are like constantly A, in theaters, and B, hitting. But also there's some controversy about, you know, Orphan First Kill and theaters versus streaming, et cetera, et cetera. We'll talk about all that as well. But thank you again for being on the show. Let's talk about Orphan First Kill. Who exactly was it that was like, we need a sequel to the surprise hit Orphan from, you know, 2008, 2009, whenever that came out? We need more Esther. We need more Esther.
The answer is nobody needed it. It just sort of happened. Like, this is one of the funniest comments I always get of, like, who the fuck needed this? Am I allowed to say swear in this show?
Yeah, that's fine.
It's like, who asked for this movie? The answer is nobody. But what I'm glad is that people have embraced it. Yeah, so, like, it took years to get this done. Probably 2014, one of my best friends, David Leslie Johnson McGoldrick, who wrote the first Orphan, it's the movie that launched his career. He had, when that movie came out, just to preface, I went opening weekend to see it in the theater with him. And I sat between David and little, at the time, 12-year-old Isabel Furman. And I, you know, never seen Orphan. So I was like, oh, this little kid is sitting next to me and I'm watching the movie and I'm watching this like evil kid get more and more evil. And I finally watch her kill a nun with a hammer. And I'm looking over at this kid like, what the fuck? Oh my God. I can't believe this cherubic, adorable little girl is just a psycho murderer. So it was an absolutely terrific experience in the theater with my friend and the star. And I'm a big fan of gothic horror. I just feel like this is a gothic horror movie, at least the original one was. And so I had also been in a writer's group for 20 years with a group of guys and women who just all sort of came up together. And one of them was David Johnson McGoldrick. And so he had read me a million times. And so a few years later, he came to me and he's like, hey, man, I have this batshit awesome idea for an Orphan prequel that tells the story of how she gets here from Estonia. You know, but at the time he was writing Aquaman and Aquaman 2 and all this giant stuff taking him all over the world. And he's like, I don't have the bandwidth or the time to write this, but this is so up your alley. Would you be interested? If we could find anybody to pay you to write the screenplay, would you be interested? And I'm like, hell yeah, man. Orphan's one of my all-time favorite movies. And I love scary kid movies. I've always gravitated toward them and I've always wanted to write one. And so we set a breakfast where all we had was, hey, this is the story of how Esther gets here from Estonia. And I mean, I don't know if your listeners have already seen the movie. I'm not sure how deep to go into it. But basically, you know, there was this challenge of how to make Esther, you know, the villain of the first movie into the protagonist of the second. And of course, you know, how do you make your shark the hero is you put it up against a meaner shark. And so basically we set a breakfast with the people from Silver Pictures and Dark Castle and the original director, Jean-Michelet Serra. And we had a breakfast and David and I basically just told him that. We said, this is the story of how Esther gets here from Estonia. We're going to pit her against someone worse. And that's pretty much it. And it was just a lot of times I'm discovering, you know, in a career, a lot of times you pitch for 20 minutes every detail of a movie and you don't get the job. And sometimes you pitch for 10 seconds and you do get the job. But what happened, we left that breakfast feeling really, this is, you know, years ago, 2015 maybe, feeling really good. And then we didn't hear anything for a day, a week, a month, a year, and 2 years went by. We didn't hear anything. I completely forgot about it. I went off and did a bunch of other stuff. And at the time, I had just come off of doing a draft of Thundercats for Warner Brothers, which was like my first, you know, giant scale world building. And I'm just like a little thriller writer. I'm a horror guy. And I had just come off of that. And it was like world building. You got to build, you know, one world and then blow it up and then build another world, you know. And it was just this mind-boggling scale that I came off of just feeling completely burnt out, wondering if I even knew how to do this anymore. And at that moment, I happened to be on vacation and my then agent called and he's like, "Hey man, did you pitch on an Orphan prequel?" I was like, "What?" He's like, "I don't know, man. I just got a call about an Orphan prequel." I'm like, "I attended a breakfast 2 years ago." Like, that's the last I heard of it. He's like, "We just got an offer. Do you want to write the Orphan prequel?" And I'm like, "Fuck yeah, 100%. I do." Cause like, you know, I really had it clear in my head. I that's the tone I can slip in and out of very easily, as opposed to, you know, writing a huge action movie with six protagonists where every protagonist has to be serviced in every fight against six antagonists. It's like, yeah. Fucking, so like, oh my God, scary kid in a house with a family. I can do that all day. So I was like, hell yeah, total palate cleanser. And I jumped in and, you know, we hammered out a plot. And I just got to work. And it was one of those scripts that just felt right from the start. Like from fade in, it just typed easily. And a lot of times that's a good sign. And yeah, just crank this thing out. And Dark Castle was happy with it. But nothing happened. It just sort of sat there again for another, I mean, this would have been 2018 or something that I wrote it. Like finally around 2020. As COVID was kicking off, like suddenly we had a director for it, William Brent Bell. And I was like, holy shit. And we had a new studio, E1, and it just started gaining momentum. And you kind of watch these things incrementally move forward. You know, there's no such thing as a green light. You know, the green light is a fucking myth. A green light is actually just this incremental series of tiny little steps that can go away at any time. And for me, the sign that your movie's actually probably going to get made is when people start taking flights. And that's, you know, that to me was like, oh my God, suddenly we had Julia Stiles on board. And what was crazy was we made this movie in what, late 2020. So we were in peak pre-vaccine COVID, one of the only movies that was made during this period where, like, you know, everything was 6 feet apart. Everything was in face shields. You know, I watched the movie and what I see is Julia Stiles having just taken off a face shield before she said her line. I watched that love scene and I go, they were wearing face shields and standing 6 feet apart until the director yelled action. And we made this movie in those circumstances, again, pre-vaccine, in Winnipeg, in winter, in a tiny little house, and somehow nobody got COVID. It was during Winnipeg's biggest peak of COVID. And the only person in production who caught COVID was me. And I was 3,000 miles away here in Los Angeles. And I made an ill-advised trip to Home Depot, you know, and ended up laid up for 10 days. And somehow they all escaped it.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So you were kind of watching remotely.
Yeah.
Were they?
I had a live feed.
You in the live feed, or
it was amazing. I wish I could do this on every movie. They gave me a live feed from Video Village, so I saw everything that Camera One and Camera Two were seeing, and that includes them just turning on the cameras at 7 a.m. and it's just they're on and the mics are on from even when everything's just getting set up. So I just would get my coffee in the morning and I would plop down and just watch and observe and basically eavesdrop and then text. You know, if I saw something was, you know, overtly not happening the way it should, you know, dialogue wise, you know, I would be able to shoot a text to Brent and be like, hey, you know, it's the meaning of the line is really this, you know, mm-hmm. it might be a good note to give, that kind of thing. But for the most part, I just sat back and watched. At the time, my wife, Lori Evans Taylor, she was prepping her first directorial feature that she wrote and directed. And so she was psyched to be able to sit next to me for 9 hours a day and just watch a movie get made. And just, you know, learn all the, you know, terminology that had slipped through the cracks of the books she had read and the director she had talked to. And, you know, you just get to see on set. She wanted on set experience, but it's fucking COVID. There were no sets to visit.
Yeah.
So that was a big, that was a big plus. We got to do it together.
That's pretty cool. That's cool. It's interesting hearing you talk about writing this character, because it's funny. We had joked a little bit on Twitter about iconic movie villains, and you know, you suggested very humbly Esther as a new iconic movie villain. But I do think that there's something very intense and different about her this time than in the first movie, in the sense that it does feel like there's something a little more intentional about some of the, like smoking the cigarette in the car or something. So how do you, as the guy who comes in to write the sequel, you know, after having loved the first one, how do you kind of balance that effort to make her a little extra, mm-hmm. shall we say, and also stay true to the original character? That obviously there are beats that you have to follow and plot points that you have to get to make that work.
That's what got me excited about the movie to begin with, is because if you recall, the last 5 minutes of the first movie are where you get to see behind the curtain with her. You get to see her be, you know, am I allowed to say an adult?
Yeah.
You know?
Spoilers for the, you know, 13-year-old hit movie Orphan coming up.
Yeah, honestly. Seriously. But like, I remember when I first started talking about this job, I remember thinking like, oh, wait, we get to have all the fun that they couldn't have in the first movie because they had to preserve their twist. And it's like, you know, when you see her in the last 5 minutes of that movie and she's a fully fledged, you realize she's a fully fledged adult with, you know, the desires and, you know, the flaws and anger that comes with that. I was like, oh my God, we get to actually play with that. We get to see her want to drink and smoke and fuck and do all this stuff that like you couldn't do because she was in little pigtails acting like a kid in the first movie. And I'm like, oh my God, from the get-go, we can be like, she's a grown-up. Here's her process, you know? Here's how we, you know, and that's why moments like where she swipes the vodka from the stewardess, you know, and goes in and just starts chugging vodka in the bathroom is like, that was one of the first moments I thought of where I'm like, oh my God, we get to see her drink. We get to see her smoke. The scene in the car with Maniac, like, was again, one of the first things I thought of where I'm like, we get to see her drive. She's going to have this big scarf billowing out. And it, you know, in that way, you got to have more fun with the character because there's this whole other side of her that they couldn't explore in the first movie, and now in subsequent movies, you totally can. And it's all about the woman behind the curtain, you know? Whereas the first movie was all curtain. And then throw open the curtain at the end, like, ah!
I remember seeing that movie in theaters with an audience. You know, it was a preview screening, so it was like half critics, half paying, or, you know, not paying, but regular moviegoers. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those very rare experiences that you remember for years afterwards because the oxygen just like goes out of the room. You know, people are like gasping and, you know, it was a real moment. And, you know, I'm going to just give a spoiler warning here for Orphan First Kills so we can talk a little bit about what happens in that. So if folks want to switch off, it's on Paramount Plus. You can download Paramount Plus, go watch it now. I think you can also rent it on VOD. So if you wanna go do that, do
still
that.
Still in a few theaters too.
Still, it actually is. It's funny. I Googled it to see if it was still in theaters here in Dallas, and it is.
Nice.
So if it's still in some
we're
theaters,
in
if you want to go watch it in theaters.
Right, we were in 500. Now we're in 200.
I'm going to come back to this because I have questions about this from your perspective. But so spoilers for Orphan First Kill. If you haven't seen it yet and you want to see it, flip off and come back later. So you know, in this movie, there is a similar twist. There is a, you know, have a big reveal in the middle again. And I'm curious from your POV as the writer, you know, how do you hit that without it A, being obvious, but also B, without just doing a rehash of the first one? Because I'll be honest, as I was watching Orphan First Cut, I was like, okay, this is good, but like it feels like we're hitting a lot of the same beats here. And like, oh no, this is totally different.
Yeah, it's funny. I think we drew that out to the absolute maximum amount of time that we could have. And it's funny. I watch it in the theater. I popped into at least a dozen screenings. A lot of times with William Brent Bell, he and I just go drink it, you know, get some beers at Bubba Gump and walk into the City Walk Theater and just like watch audiences watch the twist. And it's great. But one thing I have noticed is that people's patience is just starting to fray a little bit when the twist gets there. And then there's this like boost of energy and everyone goes, what the fuck? And it becomes this whole other movie for the second half. And you just feel the air come back into the room and you're like, oh, okay. Like now we're doing this. I completely agree that, you know, for the first half, like we're kind of lulling you into a feeling of, well, we're going to have some fun showing you Esther's process behind the curtain, but ultimately she's doing stuff she's done before. We're just showing it, you know, we're showing, you know, the mindset behind it. And what's funny is that there were scenes that ended up on the cutting room floor that I really, really miss, but I realized if they were in there, we would have pushed that crucial 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 4 minutes, and we might have lost some people. Because I did see that a little bit on social media. I would see like, oh man, I was just about to give up on this movie and holy fuck. And I'm like, oh, thank God you lasted those couple of minutes. And it's like, yeah, we had to lose a kill or two to move that twist up. But you know, ultimately those are things we can use in three.
Yeah. Are we going to see an orphan second kill, third? I don't know how many kills were up.
I would
to
love now, to. But, it would, you know, it would be. I don't even know what the process would be. I'm cursed with hyphens in my career. You've probably noticed. So yeah, it's going to end up being like orphan second kill or some shit. But I don't know. I mean, I know that you know the brainchild behind Orphan, the real sort of heart of Orphan, is David Leslie Johnson McGoldrick, and who's the writer, and Alex Mace, who's the producer. And they're sort of the gatekeepers of Esther. And I mean, we all had a terrific experience on this, so I would hope they would come back to me, because honestly, I love it. Like, I'm doing a lot of different kinds of movies now, but like, honestly, this is the kind of shit I love doing. I could write, I told these guys, they kind of were like, hey, you know, are you interested in, you know, you've got kind of a big year, like, you're interested in doing a third Orphan movie? And I'm like, yes, 100%, yes, I would do it in a fucking second. So I'm waiting for the official ask, and hopefully it'll come. But I would totally do it. Yeah. I would love it. I would. She's just fun.
I mean, it is fun, and you know, obviously Isabel Furman is great in this movie, but Julia Stiles, like almost a revelation. Mm-hmm. Like I was so into the reveal again halfway through that for folks who have not seen it and have still stuck with the show, it turns out that she's actually a killer too, and she has covered up the murder of her daughter, who Esther Isabel Furman is supposed to be, you know, the returned she is impersonating and is insinuating herself into the family. But she's so good in this. She's so just really magnetic to watch. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's so fun. It's so fun to watch things cut together, too, and come from, you know, you watch take after take, and not that we had a ton of takes. We were shooting in Winnipeg and COVID. I think people wanted to get through shit as quickly as possible. But, like, you watch it cut together, and you go, oh, my God, that thing she just did with her eyes is so goddamn evil. And, like, I didn't notice that on the day of. I didn't notice that choice she made. And it's so funny, because, honestly, I watch the movie, and I go, how the hell do people not see this twist coming? There are so many hints. You know, I think that the... You know, I watched that scene where the family gathers at the airport and welcomes her home, and the brother hugs her and just has this look of like, I don't think this is my sister. And it's like he's got that sort of eyes, and I'm like, oh God, they're gonna see that shot, and they're gonna know. Oh, they're gonna know, and they don't.
Well, I do think the first one helps with this, right? Because again, you have that sensation of like, okay, this feels a little bit like a retread, like the brother is standoffish like the original mm-hmm. brother, right? Like okay, that's kind of the same thing. But it's funny, when you put it like that, I was watching it again last night to prep for this, and as I was watching it, I was like, okay, they're very clearly setting up the reveal. You just can't see mm-hmm. it. You can't. It's very well hidden. It is great. And I would have loved to have seen it with an audience in a theater. What exactly is the story here between this movie getting a day and date release, more or less? What happened there?
I mean, look, when you're the screenwriter, you know, a lot of times you're not privy to these conversations. Yeah. But my perception of it was that Paramount was looking at this and going, well, this is a good, fun movie, but it's a prequel to a small, you know, relatively small hit from 13 years ago. Like, I could mm-hmm. see how they're like, this could either work or this could be like a complete shit show in terms of release. So, I mean, they touted it as like, we're going to experiment with this big new, you know, idea of complete platform release on the same day. You know, which they announce to you very like, we're going to do this. And you're kind of like, isn't that going to fuck the theaters? You know, it's like, But then, you know, honestly, I didn't know what to expect. Honestly, I thought this movie might completely fail or be hated. I didn't know how the horror community was going to react to it. Part of me was hoping like it might even just sort of fade away so that it, you know, like in case people hated it, like at least it wouldn't, you know, explode in my face. But I noticed when advanced screening started happening, and I'm trying to remember who it was, it might've been like John Squires or somebody, who just did sort of a blind item of like, I just saw a little horror movie that I thought would be shitty. And actually, I totally loved. And I remember that it was, you know, a Monday or something. I remember thinking, oh, my God, what if that's ours? Because I'm trying to think of what else it could be, you know? And I just remember thinking, and then I saw a couple more like that. And I'm like, I'm beginning to think they're talking about OFK. And just sure enough, this reaction occurred and like the horror community embraced it. I'm like, they're the ones I was most worried about because they look at me. They look at my track record like, who the fuck is this guy? You know, and this movie's 13 years late and Isabelle's playing a 12-year-old at 25. Like this movie has every reason not to work. Everything working against it. And for whatever reason, people have just embraced it. And what's funny is like the movie that went out, I still feel is like a movie that we were halfway through post. And then I just sort of, I stopped getting emails and suddenly that's the movie. You know, there were still like lines where I'm like, I want that removed, you know, and like you just never get your email responded to. And then the movie comes out. You're like, oh, so this is it. I guess this is the movie. You know, I never feel like something's finished. As a writer, you have very little control, except, you know, when you're writing ADR lines. But like, I'll give you an example. Julia had an improv line where I guess Brent was sort of like, just say something about the parrot. And she basically was like, You know, all parrots are, what is it? All macaws are parrots, but not all parrots are fucking macaws, right? Yeah. And she just said this. And I remember watching her say this on the day of and going, what does that even mean? Like, I don't get this joke. Like, okay, there's a weird take. All right, you know? And then I watched it end up in the cut. And I just never got the line. I was like, I don't even understand what she's saying here, you know? And it stayed in the movie and I kept going, I think we should, you know, maybe lose that. And then I would go to theaters and that line kills every single time. The audience cracks up laughing and I sit there going, I still don't get it. I don't understand what the fuck that line is. A guy tweeted the other day, he's like, the Oscar for best original screenplay for a single line goes to Dave Coggeshall for All Macaws Are Fucking Parrots. And I'm like, dude, I didn't write that line. Like,
that's so funny. That line. God, that is funny. That is funny. That line jumped out to me as well as you know what it is? It's a very humorously patrician sort of mm-hmm. line. It's like, how do you not understand this? That, you know, the differences between macaws and parrots. Come on. It's like, the difference between a rapier and a broadsword. It works for the character.
Yes, people do that exactly. After. They're like, is he using an épée or a foil? Because I don't believe that an épée you could actually stab somebody with in the climax, you know. You're right. I think that's actually the source of, that's why the joke works. We went for something similar in a line that got kind of butchered, which was the get Gunner Pajalsta line, where, you know, it's basically just a rich kid using the one Russian word he knows, you know, Pajalsta. But on the day of, the actor pronounced it Pajalsta. And like, I remember texting Brent going, that's not how you pronounce the word. This fucking kid would know how to pronounce the word, you know, because it's the one Russian word he can trot out. Yeah. And like, that's what little rich, highly private school educated kids do. They flaunt their education even as they're sucking down beers. And I remember just, and he did a second take with Pajalsta, and I'm like, fucking, pronounce the word right, you know? So it ended up in the cut as Pajalsta, and I just kept being like, dude, we have got to ADR this thing. We've got to ADR this thing. And again, they didn't, and it ended up in the movie, and the audience laughs. And I think the way Brent explained it to me, he's like, look, he's a guy who knows his one Russian word, but he doesn't even know how to pronounce it because he's this total douchebag. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, like if we could take, you know, if people actually go on that journey, you know, go down that rabbit hole to understand a line. But again, audience liked it. So this was, a lot of these were a humbling lesson in me realizing that my radar is sometimes just off. And that sometimes you fight battles and you should maybe step back and look at it from 35,000 feet and be like, am I wrong here? Because as you see audiences react to the movie, you're like, shit, they love a line that I hated. Or they hated a line that I loved. You know, they're always, you can always tell from an audience, like early on, if it's going to be an audience that digs the movie based on, I found that one of the sort of canary in the coal mine lines is when the doctor is explaining to the art history teacher, like the history of Esther, and he says to the family, you know, he's describing what she did to the last family who took her in, and there's like crime scene photos of just like blood and mayhem. And she's like, and when he rebuffed her advances, let's just say she lives here now in a mental institution, yeah. You know? And that line to me is one of those lines where you're like, the audience cracks up on that line, like you're in for a good time. And if they don't, you're like, okay, we're going to have to, I really hope we win them over, you know?
Yeah. Did you guys preview this for test audiences or
I don't know. That's honestly, I don't know. I did not even know the movie was coming out until like 3 weeks before it came out. They're like, hey, it's coming out with this giant release. And we, you know, I guess you want to talk about theaters later, but,
Well, let's talk about that because this is a movie I wish I had seen with an audience because I feel like that sort of reaction, as you've seen, you know, at theaters is something that is fun to experience.
I will say there's two big reaction, like there's the twist. And what I love about the twist is like the air goes when the gunshot happens and you pan to Julia. And then you have the cut, and then the line that always like sends you into the second half of the movie that the audience tends to dig is she's just looking at her and she goes, let me get this straight. You're a grown-ass woman. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's one of those lines where the audience is like, oh, we're doing crime school now. Like, we're doing, okay. And the whole thing is like teaching Esther how to be Esther. Like, that's a whole Easter egg for the second movie. Is like, here, I'm going to teach you all of the tricks you're going to use in the original movie. You know, sorry, I just took a segue.
No, that's fine. I have a interpretation question. If you don't want to answer it, don't. Feel free to rebuff. But does the are we to believe that the cop believes that the mother was the killer of the original Esther? Does he think that she did it, or is he still just looking for the lost girl?
I think he knows. I think he thinks it's a JonBenet situation. You know. I think he doesn't know necessarily how it went down, but that this girl was not kidnapped, that something happened and this family has been stonewalling. And so I think, and one thing I like about Brent, the way he portrayed the cop is he portrayed him as very competent. You know, I like the fact that, you know, when the cop is sitting in his office and doing the fingerprint and realizing they don't match between the original and the new Esther, you know, he hears that sound and he actually takes the gun out of his drawer. You know, that was a choice Brent made. And I'm like, this is a competent guy who probably is a war veteran. you know, and you, it's these little moments that he gives, like with the water glass, where he notices that Esther left the room to fill her water glass and didn't fill it when she came back in. He's like, I'm fucking on to you. That's what that whole move, that's what that whole moment is supposed to be, is him looking at this little girl and being like, welcome home, kid, who I know is not the little girl. You know, and you don't necessarily know why until that moment, you know, when Esther stabbed the shit out of him and says, you know, how did you know I'm not Esther? You know, even her own mother doesn't know. And it's like, yeah, kid, she does. And that was, again, one of the first lines I thought of was like, oh, I can't wait to write that thing on page 55, right where we do this fucking turn.
Let's talk a little bit about the distribution of the movie. And again, you know, as a screenwriter, these are, you know, not necessarily your calls to make. But I am curious from your perspective as a filmmaker, you know, the difference between getting that theatrical release and getting the streaming release, and also just how that works for you on the business end. And what I mean here is I hear a lot of rumblings more and more every week, frankly, of people suggesting that a strike is coming. Writers Guild is headed towards a strike because the residuals are bad and the information is bad and, like, nothing is quite working in the world of streaming. As a working writer, as somebody who, you know, had this movie go day and date, and also, you know, who has worked on TV shows, et cetera, from your perspective, how is all that shaking out, do you think?
The math is an alchemy I don't understand, and I think that it benefits the companies. it's all very confusing. I don't actually know what the finances of Orphan First Kill will be, because you read about these settlements that have been reached, people like Eric Heiser, you know, for Bird Box, and suddenly there are people actually, I guess, I don't know if you'd call it suing, but, you know, sicking the Writers Guild for residual. You're basically looking for that number that would be like, look, if this were not a streaming movie, what would I have made for residuals? What am I sacrificing by having it be a streaming movie? And how do we calculate our worth? And it's just tough because, you know, we live in a world where people will watch, you know, will click a movie for 10 seconds and be like, nah, I'm not in the mood for this. And that counts as a view. It's like, I get the companies going, you know, and we're, I think ultimately the it's going to have to be all about transparency. And I know current companies are never into transparency, but I think that's what ultimately the guild action is going to be, is like, hey, we need to figure out how many eyeballs are on these things, how, you know, how long they're watching them for. We need the raw data. And I think that's probably what that effort will be about. You know, when you hear that your movie's coming out on streaming, your head immediately goes, well, okay, how does that affect my residuals? How does that affect, you know, theatrical? But theatrical, at least in my experience, does not benefit the writer too much unless you have a giant hit and it hits these benchmarks that trigger bonuses. So it's not like you get a percentage of box office.
Right.
You get, like, if the movie makes $30 million, you get a bonus. If it makes $60 million, you get another bonus, and so on and so on. But, like, that was never going to happen here. So, like, I get, you know, I have, my friend will text me and be like, dude, we're up to 32 million worldwide. And, like, your heart swells. And then you have this moment of, what does that actually mean for me? Like, that doesn't, I was like, okay, that's great for the, you know, that's great for the franchise. It's great for the distributors. And, but, like, you know, I don't get a piece of that. So it's, I don't necessarily, it would have been great to have a giant hit that would have triggered some of those bonuses. But honestly, I never expected it to be. I always thought this would be sort of a niche horror movie that would not be a big theatrical hit. But in retrospect, you know, we made, I think, $5 million domestically on less than 500 theaters, which is pretty fucking good in terms of per screen average. I think we had a very high per screen average. I think we were second next to Top Gun Maverick, you know, in terms of that at the time we were doing. And so you kind of go, you know what? This might have been, this could have been a bigger hit than it was. But honestly, I don't know what that would have meant to me financially. Yeah. I'm just psyched that people are liking it. I'm psyched that it's not, you know, I've had a couple of, you know, things that don't look great on your resume. And, you know, this one, suddenly I'm going, hey, this one does. Holy shit. That's great.
I am pleased that folks have found it, because I did enjoy it. a great deal. And it looks for the record, I mentioned this in my review, if people are listening to this and reading who had read my review, the screener link that we got was weirdly messed up. So I wrote about that a little bit, but it looks perfectly fine on Paramount Plus 4K. I watched it again last night. Like I said, looks good. So don't worry about that. If you want to check it out, and you should watch it, because it's a fun movie. I want to mention one other thing that we had talked a little bit about on Twitter before I let you go, where all of the real conversations happen, twitter.com. The world of piracy and streaming and you know, the suggestion that it does not matter to the filmmakers, to the artists, when this sort of thing, when, you know, something gets downloaded, not from Paramount Plus or not from VOD. As a filmmaker, as an artist, how do you respond to those people?
I don't actually know the extent of piracy. I have no idea if it's a epidemic that is costing shit tons of streams and money, or if it's just like a bunch of knuckleheads and it's a drop in the bucket. I actually don't know. I do take issue with the people who defend it as not theft. And their justification always is, hey, it's a drop in the bucket for HBO Max. I'm like, yeah, I'm not HBO Max. Like, streaming numbers matter to me. You know, streaming numbers matter in terms of eventually what is calculated in, they don't call them residuals. It's still a green envelope, but it's streaming. It's different. I'll just call it residuals. So it does matter. Numbers of streams matters. Numbers of rent. You know, every time someone pirates a movie, they are not paying $3.99 to rent it. You know, and that is something I get a piece of. And so there's this, I think, a willful denial from some people of like, I'm just stealing from, or I'm just borrowing something from HBO Max. I'm not actually taking something off of a shelf. It's a copy of a copy, you know? And you go, yeah, that's, that you are doing some mental gymnastics to explain how that is different from grabbing lipstick off a shelf, you know? I think if you have to jump through hoops to explain why something's not theft, it's probably theft.
I think that's a good way to put it. If you have to explain why something's not theft, you've probably stolen.
And I disagree with the argument that you're only stealing from Paramount Plus, because that's just not true, and that displays a naivete about the sort of behind the scenes finances of Hollywood and your career. I mean, like, having a number one movie on, it's been number one for weeks and weeks on Paramount Plus, and that's a thing, that's a feather in your cap. That's something your agent can talk about. That's, you know, and so I would imagine that if piracy is a huge problem, and again, I don't know if it is, so it's not something I get very upset about. I get upset when people defend it as a victimless crime. You know, that's what bothers me. I actually don't know the extent of the problem. So it's not something that really drives me nuts. Except when people are like, it doesn't affect anybody, because it does.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a fair way to put it. All right, I have asked everything I wanted to ask, and I will once again plug the movie. It's on Paramount Plus. Go check it out. If you've listened to this whole thing and you haven't watched it yet, I don't know what you're doing, but you should go see it. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think people should know about the making of Orphan First Kill. I mean, I could have probably done another 10 minutes on shooting during COVID and all that. I mean, it's a fascinating little window in the world of filmmaking where, like, you know, for a year, everyone was locked down all the time and wearing masks and all that. It was crazy. But you know, I don't know if you want to talk about that or anything
else.
Well,
that's why people have flooded back to theaters. It's just like people are psyched to go have communal experiences again, you know? I will say the one cool thing that this movie freed us up to do in terms of moving forward, is the fan response to the batshit, camp of it. And has really made us realize we have a lot of freedom we can go a little crazy. Like, the options are open to us. Like, fans basically are coming out and being like, we don't care if original Esther punches her way out of the ice and fucking crawls up and stalks, like, you know, and is just her old self. Like, they don't care. They just want more Esther. It's going to be, you know, Isabel's getting older and older with each passing year. And, like, the idea of making prequel is like, wow. And we can do it. And what's great is that we can still do it because the fans are like, fuck it. Like, we'll go on this journey with you. Like, which we didn't know if they would. We thought they'd be like,
yeah.
But I think what people appreciate is big swings. People are like, they're taking a big swing. And I think that's what this horror fall thing is. They're
hot or fall.
I think people are psyched that movies are like taking big swings. We've kind of moved out of that era of the, you know, the easy blue-tinted remake dominating horror. And now we have like shit like Mandy and like Barbarian and like Orphan First Kill, where you're just like, blah! You're just like throwing crazy onto the screen and people are psyched.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very interesting moment in horror right now. Like you mentioned Barbarian. I mean, there's also Pearl, you know, from A24. Bodies is kind of in that realm. That's more thriller than horror, I guess. But like, it's a fun time. I mean, how you know, what have you seen in theaters and loved? I guess in this space, or what have you seen period and loved in this space over the last few months here?
That's tough because a lot of these things are theaters only, and I have, you know, two kids and a fucking I'm flying to Atlanta all the time. I don't know, like. I just saw X. Like I'm behind. Uh-huh. So some of these things I haven't actually seen. Like we sat down to watch Pearl the other night, and you can't get it. It's ungettable. Yeah. You have to go to the theater to see it. And so it's, you know, honestly, what has been a big problem for me is that we lost our sitter. Our sitter moved to Arizona, and we do not have a sitter for our two kids. And so my wife and I are like, one of us can go out and see a movie. You know, that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, that's a very relatable problem. That is a super relatable problem. All right.
We're seeing Halloween Ends tomorrow night, so we'll see if that's any good in the theater.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Fun.
Is that out?
It's not out this weekend.
That's out.
We're going to a friend's family.
Oh, nice. Very exciting. Cool. Well, you'll have to let us know. We'll have to let me know how that is.
I have to see Halloween Kills first.
It's good. I like all those. I like the first mm-hmm. two. Anyway, I haven't seen the new one yet.
But I like Bonkers. I like this script was written as Orphan First Kill was written. It was called Esther, by the way, up until like right before release, and then my curse of the hyphen reared its ugly head, and suddenly I had another hyphenated movie. I wrote it as like a straight gothic thriller. Like it's a, you know, it was not written to be as campy as it was, and Brent leaned into that and poured some gasoline on it, and it really worked. That's what people really, really responded to.
Check it out again. Go sign up for Paramount Plus. Watch it. Keep it on the charts over there. You're doing a good thing by doing that. All right. I am Sonny Bunch. Thanks again, David, for being on the show. I really appreciate it. I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I'll see you guys then.